other mysterious phenomena have occurred simultaneously in opposite corners of the globe. Areas heaviest hit are reported to be the Ural Mountains and the Rockies. The United Democracies have also reported tidal waves reaching a height of 160 feet, battering port installations along the coasts of all five continents. Countless lives have been lost, and property damage is impossible to estimate. Top scientists at UD headquarters have been unable to locate any subterranean or atmospheric cause for these devastating phenomena, which have been striking concurrently in different parts of the world, threatening the Earth with incalculable destruction if it does not cease. The latest theory is that the upheavals may be due to some gravity disturbance in outer space never before encountered.
Monday, March 19th, 10 a.m. Space Command Headquarters. General Norton, Chief in Command, arrives to begin the full-scale search of outer space to determine the validity of this theory and take all possible steps to halt the catastrophic destruction.
Hello and welcome to The Bloody Pit. I am Rod Barnett.
And I am John Hudson.
And we are here tonight to talk to you about a film you may or may not have seen. I'm betting not. Even though it is readily available on a Region 1 DVD, it's just hidden away on a double feature disc you may have never spotted before. But we're going to point you toward it.
That's exactly right. And it's so hidden away that when Rod suggested this, I didn't think I had the movie until he mentioned the co-feature on the DVDs. Oh, yeah, I do have that.
Well, listen, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk about a specific science fiction film made in the mid-60s in Italy. Before we get to that, I want to just go ahead and reel off the name of the film that you would find it under if you wanted to seek it out on DVD for yourself is War Between the Planets. And it is on DVD paired up as a double feature with Creation of the Humanoids. Mm-hmm. And it says a lot that Creation of the Humanoids has a really good reputation, and I have yet to watch it, but I've watched War Between the Planets three or four times.
So, I watched it twice this week.
So there you go. That's what I'm talking about. Oh, we're weird people. But War Between the Planets is, as we say, an Italian-made science fiction film in the 1960s. It is known by many different titles, not just War Between the Planets. It's also known as Mission Wandering Planet. Very well known under Planet on the Prowl, which I think it was. I think that's a title it was shown on television under for a long time. And strangely enough, also, the Italian title is actually translated as The Wandering Planet, which kind of is a decent enough mm-hmm. title for it. It kind of gives you. It's not really accurate to say that it's about a wandering planet. It's an asteroid, people. But hey, come on.
But it's more accurate than saying that there's a war.
It's true. There is no war. No. War. There is no war. But let's get right out. Let's before we get any further, if you're hoping to watch this film and find yourself watching a war between planets, it's not going to happen. But like I say, this film, 1960. Well, okay. The United States release date is officially 1966. The movie was produced in 1965. But we will get into the details of that in a few minutes. Right now, we're going to take a quick break. We will come back. Here's some bits and pieces of dialogue, crazy, crazy dialogue from the film itself.
All right, Dobie, calm down and give it to me slow.
We were out checking on a report of a gyro disturbance when all
on
of
the B-level?
On B-level.
And?
There was a wind.
A wind? Have you gone out of your mind?
That's right, there was a wind, but don't take my word for it. You'll find out. I can tell you when it happened. It was like a real twister. The whole section buckled right out of shape. I wasn't prepared for it, so I ordered everyone back in as fast as they could.
Lieutenant, where do you think you're going?
Standard operating procedure, Commander. A communications officer is assigned to every mission. That's not routine.
Okay. And then?
The guys were sucked right off. The tie line snapped like that.
How many?
Three of them.
Couldn't reach them?
It was too risky.
Okay, let's move out.
All right. As we said, this is a 1965/66 science fiction film. And what this is a set of... there's four of these movies. And one might be discourteous or cruel and say, yeah, they all look the same. No. They are not all the same. But most of them... Well, let's just explain. There are four of these films made by the same director, and they are commonly referred to as the Gamma One Quartet.
Quadrilogy.
Quadrilogy ain't a fucking word.
It is on my Alien box set.
Yeah, get rid of that and get the DVD, get the Blu-rays, because that's some bullshit. But what it is there are four of these films, generally known as the Gamma One films, and all four of them were made at the same time. What it is that director Antonio Margheriti had made two science fiction films on the cheap in 1960 and 1961 in Italy. One called Spaceman and one called Assignment Outer Space. Now, these were low-budget science fiction films produced in Italy, which was not something that you could say for roughly, well, the 60s. It just didn't happen. Margheriti directed them, and they were quite profitable. He went on to direct a few other films, including a movie called The Golden Arrow, which was a co-production between his producer, Titanus Pictures, and MGM, who was looking for that kind of Arabian adventure storyline. They wanted that kind of thing, and it being produced in Italy gave them a head up. So, after successfully producing The Golden Arrow for them, and then being very happy with the quality of the film, and seeing how much money had been made on the two cheap science fiction movies he'd made just a couple of years before, they offered him and his production people enough money to make four movies all at the same time in a very cost-conscious way. In other words, build all the sets, use the sets for all four films, and here's the clincher, Antonio Margheriti and his team were very, very good at producing the special effects themselves. Antonio Margheriti is a very unique individual when you look at genre film directors from Italy, especially during this period, because he was very hands-on with the special effects, to the point where it became a family thing where he was doing these special effects as his career moved on with his sons as well. The four films in the Gamma One series, let's just call it that, were this film, War Between the Planets, or Planet on the Prowl. And remember, I'm going to throw some titles at you, and it's going to get confusing, so hang on.
But Planet on the Prowl is a great title.
That's a great title, and it's actually a better title than War Between the Planets.
Because the planet is sort of prowling.
It's true. It does not growl, but it does prowl. There's also Wild Wild Planet, War of the Planets, War of the Planets, and Snow Devils. Now, Snow Devils is the only one that you cannot confuse in any way, shape, or form. Snow Devils is a lot of people say it's the weakest of them, but I don't know if that's necessarily true. But I, of course, have rewatched Snow Devils recently, too, because that's just how I am. Anyway.
It's a sad state.
It's not that sad. Anyway, there are four Gamma One films, and this is one of them. And we want to focus in on this because over the next year or so, we're going to return to the films of Antonio Margheriti, and we're going to demonstrate just how amazing a director he is. Now, very little has been written or talked about with Margheriti, unfortunately, because he doesn't really have a definable genre that you can say he's attached to. Because Margheriti made films in every damn genre you can think of. He's not like Mario Bava. When you think of Mario Bava, generally you think of horror films. He made a lot of other kinds of films, but generally, Mario Bava made horror films. Same with Fulci. If you think about Dario Argento, generally you think about giallos or horror films. But with Margheriti, he was able to make movies in every damn genre you can think of. We're talking crime films, science fiction films, fantasy films, giallo, gothics, action movies, alien movies, weird-ass alien ripoffs. All kinds of stuff. He even made some comedies, but I have not ventured into the comedies. I can't vouch for any of his comedies. And he also made a couple of damn fine spaghetti westerns. So Margheriti was kind of jack of all trades, master of most. He was quite good because I've yet to see an Antonio Margheriti film that I didn't enjoy. They go up and down the scale on whether I consider them to be a good film or an okay film. And in some cases, kind of a dud, but I'm never bored. Well, not always, but I'm almost never bored with an Antonio Margheriti film. Because there's a certain level of quality that his films just do not sink beneath. Now, One of the first podcasts we did, one of the first shows we did for this podcast, The Bloody Pit, we covered an Antonio Margheriti film. Mr. Hudson, you were not a part of that. I sat down with Jeff and Troy, and we covered You're the Hunter from the Future.
And I'm, being the red-brown mark that I am, I'm very, very hurt to this day about that.
Well, maybe we'll do a supplemental commentary track on You're the Hunter from the Future, so you can speak out about your love for Reb Brown.
I just want to do just Reb in general.
Maybe we could cover just Reb Brown's Captain Movie TV movies.
Captain America?
I'm sorry, Captain America TV movies. I can't even talk. I get so excited when we talk about Reb Brown.
We like to call ourselves Rebels.
That was the sound of me in pain, folks. But nevertheless, back to the topic at hand. Antonio Margheriti. He was able to make all kinds of films. It didn't seem to matter what kind of film you put him in charge of. He could craft a well-made movie. Do you have any idea? Do you have enough knowledge of Antonio Margheriti to know what, which of his movies you have seen?
Actually, no. And that's where this is going to be interesting for me, because I've seen Yor, but okay, I've never put his name to it. So this is going to be kind of interesting for me, because I'm going to see stuff that I didn't even realize the guy was involved with. As I said earlier, I didn't even realize I had this movie on my shelf. Now, I know it's hard to believe for anybody who's listening to this, but I do have movies that I haven't watched on my shelf, and occasionally those start to get away from you a little bit. So this is going to be fun. I'm going to learn a lot, and we'll probably provide the voice of somebody new coming into this.
That's cool. That's
against
cool.
Rod, who's obviously quite expert at this. So I think this is going to be fun.
Well, here's the thing. I bet you, I'm going to reel off a few titles, but I'm betting you that you've seen at least a few of these movies. I'll bet, let's see, let's start with Cannibal Apocalypse.
Yep.
See, the John Saxon movie filmed in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
See, he made that movie. Have you seen Killer Fish?
No, but I do have it on my shelf.
There you go. How about the spaghetti western Take a Hard Ride with Lee Van Cleef?
Yes, I have. That
he also, made that.
Also on my shelf, but I have seen that one.
How about Seven Deaths in a Cat's Eye?
I'll be darned. Okay, I've seen a bunch of this guy's stuff, just have never put it together, so...
The one of my favorite spaghetti westerns he made, And God Said to Cain.
Haven't seen that.
It's a very good Klaus Kinski western. Highly recommended. The Naked, the Evil, and the Savage, also known as Naked You Die, which is a weird little giallo. He took over from Mario Bava about 1968 or 69.
I don't think I've seen that.
There's a good DVD of it out there. Recommended.
It might be up on my Mario Bava shelf.
Well, his name's not attached to it, so...
It might still be there. I've got a couple of... like Bava sort of things connected in the corner, films. connected things up there too. So,
well, as you can see from that, there is one other that got a really nice DVD release over here that you might have seen. The Last Hunter.
Don't have that one. Haven't seen that.
Kind of First Blood style film. Well, you'll see. We may get to cover that one.
Sounds good. Well, no, I'm in. This is going to be fun.
Well, Antonio Margheriti could make, as we say, just make about any kind of film you wanted to. And when he made these four films back to back, they're a joy to watch. It is in a way kind of like watching a really weird set of TV movies, because strangely enough, they were originally produced to be shown on Italian television.
Okay.
But they got released theatrically. MGM thought they were of high enough quality to actually release them to theaters in a lot of different countries. Now, with the Gamma One films, he finished all four of the movies in 3 months. That's start to finish.
That's amazing if they're all like the one that we've seen so far.
Exactly. Now, they were very crafty in how to set things up and get the most bang for their buck. But I don't think it's any big. I don't think it's going to come as any big surprise to say that the special effects in these movies are not, shall we say, up to modern CGI standards.
That would be true.
Now, let me take this opportunity before we start discussing the story of this film. And by the way, the movie is really only about an hour and 15 or 16 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if the story is really long or it takes that long to get into it. But had you seen this movie before we decided to cover it?
I had not.
Okay.
I had not. And I thought I had seen Wild Wild Planet long ago. But as I watched this movie, it didn't ring any bells. So I'm not sure if I've seen it or not.
Okay. If you had, yeah, some of the things in this movie would have rung some bells.
Mm-hmm.
But you've seen enough Italian movies from the 60s and 70s, I would say, to probably have recognized some of the faces in this, including, mm-hmm. I would have to say, the lead actor.
Mm-hmm.
Going under the pseudonym of Jack Stewart is Italian actor Giacomo Rossi Stewart. So Jack Stewart's not that bad a fake name.
That's pretty close.
That's not
bad.
Who, honestly, I think it's wild to know how many films I've seen this guy in. First of all, he was in the Vincent Price movie, The Last Man on Earth, mm-hmm. which was shot in Italy. He was the dead neighbor next door.
Okay.
He was, what was it, Ben something? I can't remember the character.
Can't remember.
He was the main character, the doctor character, in Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill.
Okay.
I just recently saw him in a film called Something Creeping in the Dark, which is pretty cool.
It's a great title.
It's not bad. He had a role. He had a small role in The Five-Man Army. He was also in Bava's Knives of the Avengers. He was in several Peplum films, including a couple for Umberto Lenzi. He was in a number of spaghetti westerns, Gunfight at Red Sands, Duel at Sundown, and of course he was also in The Night Evelyn Came Out of the Grave.
Oh, great. Yeah, but it's been a long time since I've seen that great movie.
But he is one of those guys who, he's just strikingly handsome. I mean, mm-hmm. he really is. And in this movie, he sports a hairdo that's...
I was just going to say, that
man,
hair...
Oh my God.
That hair could not exist in Earth's gravity.
Well, let's just say that hair, the Jack Stewart, a.k.a. Mr. Rossi Stewart's hair in this film, is... gravity-defying is not a bad phrase for mm-hmm. it, but also sculpted gold. I mean, it's really, it's just astonishing. It's like well-spun beauty. He could be ugly, but with that hair, women would still want to be near him.
That's true. Michael Landon would have been jealous of that hair. And it was so perfect. There's one scene where, as they're in one shot, the hair is perfect. But then from the side shot, as they cut back and forth in dialogue, you can see one strand astray. And that strand jumps out like, what are you doing, strand? You're betraying that coif.
You're betraying that actor. What are you doing to him? Don't you understand the level of coolness this man has? Well, he was not only in he was, of course, this being one of the four Gamma 1 films. He's in this one, and he is also in Snow Devils. I just think it's amazing to think that, and he plays the same character. These films. He's the lead in two of them, this one and Snow Devils. He's also, there was another actor who was the lead in the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of this is, it really is kind of like watching. I don't know. Would be a good example, like an episode of Law and Order where you're following different different characters around the same space station.
Okay, that's kind of neat.
But kind of stupid. I don't know why I just said it. But anyway, nevertheless, the story in this film, and like I say, this is actually the shortest of the Gamma 1 films, mm-hmm. Oddly enough. And it's also the only one that is packed with this much voiceover narration, which is kind of weird. There's a lot of the story points that are gotten across via newscasters, where we see news reports going on. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the fact that people on Gamma 1 are paying attention to the news reports is a plot point at a certain early on in the movie, where Commander Rod Jackson, and yes, his name is Commander Rod Jackson, and I didn't pick the film because the lead character, who's so beautiful, shares my first name. But it is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I thought of you.
Yeah, well, how could you not?
True.
Because honestly, when I look in the mirror,
I see Rod Jackson.
I see Commander Rod Jackson. And I think, where are the Italian babes in my life doing what I want to and jumping when I say, don't let them watch those damn newscasts?
That's right. They hate the newscast there. Everybody in charge hates those newscasts.
I know, they really do.
As far as the voiceovers, I actually kind of like that. You could tell that was sort of papering over something. Well, yeah, but I thought it gave it almost a documentary quality at times.
Exactly.
Which
and
I like.
And it really does. And it helps at certain different points because, yeah, I can't tell if it was primarily done to paper over plot points where maybe they shrunk the film down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like maybe they edited, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 10 minutes out of it. I don't know. And by using this voiceover, they're kind of moving it along a little bit faster, making sure that this plot point is clear, making sure that you're aware of why these characters are doing what they're doing. But it does help, and it is interesting. I don't mind it at all. And I even like the voiceover actually does at points give you information that clarifies a couple of things.
Oh, absolutely.
And for that, I am very thankful.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And it never gets in the way.
No.
I thought it was an okay touch. It was sort of odd how it would pop up just on occasion. It wasn't ongoing, but it works.
Well, a quick synopsis, and then we will get into details that we want to talk about the film. Essentially, it is the... do we want to say near future? Far future? It's pretty far in the future.
It's out there a little bit, yeah.
Because Gamma 1 is a wheel-shaped space station that mm-hmm. is in orbit around the Earth. Commander Rod Jackson is in charge.
And boy, is he.
But as the film begins, he is on leave on Earth. But Earth is having some problems. There are a series of earthquakes and very bad storms and really, really disruptive weather that is essentially wiping out a lot of people. A lot of people are being killed by these really rough storms, earthquakes, and all kinds of disruptive weather patterns all over the planet.
And don't forget, they also lost 50,000 pieces of mail.
I know. Oh, God. Oh, believe me, that piece of information is going in this podcast to make sure that people understand just how important at least the Italians felt that was. And I guess it must have been.
It must have been.
Would have pissed me off.
It would have.
So, I know that is an odd point to make. But, nevertheless, the film makes that point. So, United Space Command essentially has determined, and I love the way they put this, this problem seems to be emanating or originating from space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't give us any indication of why they have determined this or how they determined this, but by God, that's what they've determined.
It's a space problem.
It's a space problem. Which, it seems to me, it's more of a bad weather problem, but okay, good. I'm glad we've come to this. Needless to say, we do eventually find out that they have determined that if you plot the major events that have occurred, the major bad weather events that have occurred, they do seem to go in a straight line mm-hmm. across the face of the planet. So it would seem that something may be causing this, and it looks like you can kind of track it. Well, long story short, and in this case, and we'll discuss it, this really does feel like long story short.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes short story long. They figure out that there has to be some kind of wild planet. In other words, mm-hmm. some kind of unforeseen or unknown large extraterrestrial object mm-hmm. that is close enough to Earth to disrupt weather systems in some way. And after some searching and some very strange talk about wind in space,
mm-hmm.
we discover that there is an errant asteroid that has come in between the Moon and the Earth's orbits and is the cause of these problems. So, how do you solve a problem like an asteroid? Well, apparently, you blow it up with a nuclear device used by Bruce Willis.
I think that was the obvious answer.
By the way, I've never seen that movie.
I haven't either.
It's just, the guy who made that movie, I don't give a shit.
No need for that.
If you're a fan of Armageddon, I apologize. But between that and The Rock, Criterion damn near sunk all available bullshit levels mm-hmm. to the core of the Earth by putting those on the Criterion label. That is enough to drive me crazy. But then again, I do have to admit, I do want to buy the Blu-ray of Michael Cimino's Western?
Heaven's Gate? I kind of want to see that.
I want that. So how much better am I to want Heaven's Gate in high definition than some lug who wants to watch Bruce Willis blow up a fucking asteroid? Well,
as we discussed before we hit the record button, I just bought The Baby on Blu-ray, so I can't criticize a soul out there.
We all have odd things on DVD and Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
We really all do. If I were to come clean about some of the things I have, and I'm not going to, by the way, I want people to think of you purchasing The Baby on Blu-ray and not think of the weird shit that I bought. Because I could talk all day about, so I'm very proud to have the Hudsucker Proxy on Blu-ray, or yes, I went out of my way and I got my hands on the Golden Voyage of Sinbad on Blu-ray.
Perhaps you would like to see my Lawrence of Arabia Blu-ray.
Ah, yes, yes.
The Godfather.
I do have the Godfather films all on Blu-ray. It's true. But no, you've got The Baby, so we're just gonna...
And after we watch The Godfather, let's watch Loose Screws on Blu-ray.
Oh, God. You have Loose Screws on Blu-ray?
Yeah.
Okay, wait. Hold on, folks. We've gotten sidetracked here. Hang on. All right. We gave you a brief synopsis. And now that we're recovered and back on track, God hopes, I'm going to try to read to you a synopsis that's straight from the English language version of Antonio Margheriti's official website. Now, understand, this is roughly translated from the Italian to Korean to, I think, Wookiee, and then into English. So I want everybody to hang loose and just deal with this as I read to you the story synopsis for this film right now. A mysterious planet out of its orbit generate earthquakes and other cataclysms, traveling the space at great velocity in the direction of the Earth. The danger of a possible collisions and a full destruction of our planet, it's more than a fear. Sound like song lyrics. More than a feeling. To avoid this Armageddon, a small team of heroes, Rod Jackson, Terry, a beautiful girl, there are no commas here, I've got to fill that in, hold on, and a few others aboard a spaceship are able to reach the hostile planet, which is actually an asteroid, goddammit, land on it with a small space module. Inside of the heart of the planet, they discover a huge computer, I would like to dispute that, which controls the entire planet. What? They try to destroy it, cutting some sort of veins that connect the machine to the planet itself. But immediately the veins repair themselves. The astronauts decide to use an experimental antimatter bomb and make it explode in the heart of the planet. Dubrovsky will give his life to accomplish this mission while the others are able to return to the spaceship and reach a safe distance. Now, what... Okay, first of all, I never got the sense that the asteroid that is the quote-unquote wild planet had any kind of computerized anything on it.
Not at all. I got the sense that it was some sort of living being.
Exactly. And that's how it was like repairing itself, because it seemed
like
it was healing. Yeah, it was healing, and they would like chop it, and it was nice, and it was like blood flowing out of it, and it was really impressive. Everything had a very organic look.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless the idea... that's not communicated in the film clearly, if this is what the idea was, that this is some kind of organic machine. Could be.
And one thing, and this is a point I was going to bring up at some point, and now it's as good as any. Is there an Italian language version of this with English subtitles that goes from the original Italian cut and dialogue?
Not that I'm aware of. So, if there is, I don't know.
Okay.
I would love to, if there is one, I would love to see it. Hopefully with some very, you know, very literal English subtitles, so that we can, because Lord knows I can't speak Italian. But it is, I have the sense there's a longer version of this film somewhere.
I do too. And I'm almost would bet you my mortgage payment that there are some translations being made that aren't exact.
I'm not willing to take that bet. Because I think you are quite correct, sir. Now, here's the thing. Of the four of the Gamma One movies, this is my least favorite. It really is. This one has the most number of problems.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are wacky as hell because they're cheap. They're low budget. I won't say cheap because they look quite nice, but they're low budget science fiction films done quickly in Italy with a whole lot of can-do attitude, but only very little in the way of resources. I like the films. I enjoy them. This is, to my mind, the weakest of the four, as I said, but it still has its pleasures. The one thing this film does get on my nerves about is that, honestly, roughly the first 25 minutes of it is a crawl.
Absolutely, and this is where some of my honesty is going to come out here.
Go ahead.
You said, let's watch this. I love these movies.
Yeah.
I just think they're great, and I kind of come into this blind. So I'm watching the first one, and I'm about 15 minutes in. It's like, ooh, we're going to fight. This isn't going to go well.
Which is fine.
Because I kept waiting for something to happen.
Well, yeah, because almost nothing happens.
No, and I was disappointed because the movie starts out hot. You know, the narration is good.
Yep.
The planet's blowing up, and then the guy pulls up, you know, and then there's buildings collapsing.
Yeah.
They're like, this is in the first 45 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, wow, this is going to just be nonstop. And then, first, it stops.
And then nothing happens mm-hmm. for the next roughly 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just all this fairly dull exposition. We're introduced to the relationships between the commander and his fiance, who is also the daughter of his boss. And then he gets up to Gamma One, and we find out that he's been kind of carrying on a clandestine relationship with his kind of second in command.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes this thing where suddenly you're realizing, okay, so we've got a certain amount of soap opera here. We've got a certain amount of, sad to say, kind of cliched romantic mm-hmm. entanglement. A poorly sketched love triangle is what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
That really only pays off in one decent little scene Commander Jackson and with Terry, his kind of second in command on the space station, kind of having this little brief conversation where they're honestly a little bit concerned that, you know, there's not going to be a planet. The Earth is not going to be habitable if they can ever return to it.
Yeah, there's no future for them on Earth because it might not be there.
Right. And that's kind of neat. That's really the only payoff for that love triangle, though. That's mm-hmm. really the only aspect. That's the only point in the story where there's any real friction or any real interest generated by that whole idea.
There. One thing, though, that I guess it was sort of refreshing about that, what little information was given, is that his fiance, who Rod Jackson, nice man that he is cheating on openly. She seems like a decent person. She's not like just some harpy, like so often, you know, the person who's being cheated on is this really mean person you can't wait to see him get away from. And she seems perfectly fine.
Right.
So I thought that was at least a nice little touch that isn't the normal cliche that you get in movies like this.
Yeah, and it points towards something that could have been expanded upon and painted the main character in a less than impressive light, because if the woman that he's supposedly engaged to isn't some kind of harsh harpy or vindictive woman or cruel or mean-spirited in some way, then that paints him in a bad light, because why is he doing this to this woman?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't play around with it enough. They don't give it any more shades or detail to make us feel anything in particular mm-hmm. about it.
And of course, that's not the only thing that makes you think that Rod Jackson is kind of a prick.
He's not kind of a prick either. He is aptly named, let's put it that
yeah.
way. Rod as in Dick. So mm-hmm. yeah, he really is. This is true. He's authoritarian to the point of antagonism. I swear to God, it's my way and the highway. Mm-hmm. Even though you may have done it my way, I may still kick your ass off the mm-hmm. station. And he's really kind of I love the moment when he's kind of semi apologetic for being a dick. But he's still a dick about being a dick.
At the same time.
Yeah. Damn, man. Come on. I mean, yeah, there's a human heart beating under that, but it's like, yeah, I mean, you're still being an asshole while you're doing this.
Maybe it's the hair that
I get. There's probably a price to pay for having hair that awesome and being an asshole. Having really a prickly personality must be part of it.
It could be. Hey, we remember that soundtrack from the last
episode. I was about to say, we're gonna get that every time we record here, aren't we?
Is that you, Schmidt? You got the report on the space body seen by Echo and Loeb? What do you think of it?
You are making a mistake. It's a body so lacking in density, moving at too slow a speed.
I know, Schmidt. Yet it's there.
It's not possible for such a body to cause the disturbances we're having on Earth.
I can only pray that you're wrong.
Recon ship Loeb. No sign of Echo, sir. But we've been tailing something. Looks like an oversized asteroid. It has a strange phosphorescent quality.
It could be. Could be our baby.
What the devil is it? Look at that burst of gas. How could something like that be up here without our knowing it?
All right, I guess that's it. Let's move. Ride my tail. Recon Able, to flagship. We're maintaining course.
Okay, well, we just spent some time, you know, running down some of the things in the film that are not, shall we say, of higher quality. Some of the things that kind of irritate us about the film. But you said earlier that when you started watching the film, you thought, okay, we're going to fight on this film because I profess that I enjoyed them. And you were like, oh, God, what the fuck is going on here? Mm-hmm. So my question is, that seems to make me think that at some point the film offered you something that kind of turned you around or at least made you feel a little kinder toward it.
Yeah, I had to kind of get... And actually really didn't kick in until the second viewing.
Okay.
I had to kind of get what they were doing.
Yeah.
And
well, it's a very different flavor of film than most people are used to, I have to say.
And I think maybe part of it was that I went in expecting Star Trek, and instead I was getting lost in space.
To a degree, that's not a bad way
to
put it.
And once I sort of got that as the vibe, it's actually quite enjoyable. And I really like some of what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe didn't always achieve it perfectly, but I like the design of the thing. And of course, it's got those great 60s colors, and you know,
yeah.
It's hard not to enjoy watching stuff like that.
Well, it's beautiful. Yeah, really brightly colored, and those mm-hmm. things, and the colors really kick into gear in that section. Once they land on the asteroid,
yeah.
it's just absolutely gorgeous. Yeah,
and that's where it really got good. The asteroid, I love the design of.
Yeah,
I think that's a really great idea, and some of the effects work better than others. But
yeah.
I think that is just really cool. It does bring to mind some questions. As they're there, I wondered if hatchets are standard issue in space.
Apparently they are.
And Rod Jackson loves to hack things.
Yes.
He loves his hatchet.
There came a point when I thought, if he had two hatchets, he could just go at it, man. Just kill, kill, kill.
That's right, because he liked to use those hatchets. He just pulled them out of his little space pocket.
Well, the bright colors and the very, very interesting design of the asteroid, all of that comes down to Antonio Margheriti and his design and special effects team. It's
mm-hmm.
mostly him. He was very hands-on throughout his career with the special effects in his movies. We talked a good deal about that when we were covering Yor. Because there's a lot of miniature work in Yor, and there's a lot of miniature work in the Gamma One films, especially in this one.
Mm-hmm. And I thought the miniatures were fun. I mean, they almost always looked like miniatures, but
yeah.
but they're fun to look at.
Yeah.
And I do have to say that high def and even a DVD upscale is not a friend to the special effects in this movie.
No, they are not. And okay, my least favorite special effect in the movie, I forgive older science fiction movies a whole lot, especially in spacecraft design,
mm-hmm.
and I'm willing to forgive this movie the kind of standard spinning wheel space station problem mm-hmm. of the spinning wheel space station wobbling. I'm willing to forgive it that, but the thing that really is hard for me to overcome in the special effects department is the not just visible wires on this on the spacemen moving from one spacecraft to another. It's the fact that they're not hiding very well the fact that these guys are swinging like they're on a pendulum. So,
No, it's like those aren't wires; those are trapezes that
exactly.
they're on out there.
Exactly, and it's that where it's like that's not. I'm pretty sure that even in the '60s, we were fairly aware that that's not how objects move mm-hmm. in space. And so, to see that, it's you can either take the position that this is a stylized view of this, or a naive kind of sci-fi pulp view of the way this is a visualization of that kind of space opera kind mm-hmm. of thing, and therefore it's not to be taken literally. But at the same time, you look at it and you go, no, it just looks fucking goofus.
It does. But there were some things that, even though they look goofy, I appreciated what they were trying to do. When they turn the gravity off,
yes,
in the station and things start to float, it looks kind of dumb, but at least the idea that they had was great, that there's suddenly
yeah.
the paper is floating and the pencils and everything, and they're trying to grab the things and keep them under control.
And that's one of the reasons why I'm willing to forgive this movie and the other Gamma One films as well a lot, because there are those attempts to do something interesting,
mm-hmm.
even if it's just something visually interesting. And like you say, when they get to the asteroid, it's gorgeous. I mean, yeah, it's miniature work, and but the sets, the full size sets that they built,
mm-hmm.
the pulsing veins and the spurting fake, you know, the whatever that stuff is, it looks like blood, but whatever it is, is this asteroid a living creature?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of that kind of thing, and it's a really unique look. It's the kind of thing that you probably saw. This is made in 1965, so that's probably imagery that you had seen at that time in comic books, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely something you would have read described in a science fiction novel, especially a pulp science fiction novel, but it's not something you've probably ever seen visualized on screen until this movie. That is a definitely unique look to my mind for a movie made any time prior to 1965. I can't remember a science fiction movie with that kind of weird imagery
mm-hmm.
ever before.
that now, sort of craziness.
Yeah. Now, I talked briefly about the fact that Margaretti, and I misspoke, let me correct myself. Margaretti had made two science fiction films before he was contracted by MGM to make these four. One was called Spaceman, and it was also known as Assignment Outer Space. If you can pick up Assignment Outer Space, I picked it up on a dollar DVD years ago, and wrote up a review of it on the Bloody Pit. And the science fiction film he made after that was called, and here's where it gets confusing because you've heard this title before, folks, was called Battle of the Worlds, and that was in 1961. And the way to differentiate is the 1961 film is one that starred Claude Rains. So the Invisible Man himself was mm-hmm. in an Italian science fiction film in 1961. But the thing about Battle of the Worlds is that Claude Rains' character saves the world by blowing up something. And in a lot of ways, this movie, Planet on the Prowl, a.k.a. War Between the Planets, kind of replays that storyline to a degree. But what I find very interesting, and that doesn't bother me in any way whatsoever, because they were making four films back to back. They got to come up with four different plots, and they got to film them as quickly as possible, get the scripts written, the whole nine yards. So reusing an idea from 4 years before, I kind of get it.
Yeah, I never have a problem with that, because, you know, at the time, they weren't thinking that somebody's going to just go into the other room, pull one movie off a shelf, and then pull the other one off and say, wait, these are kind of the same.
And it's made by the same guy. Mm-hmm. How'd this happen? Huh?
So the audience that they were making those for is a lot different than we are now. So
true, true. But even from the brief plot description that we've laid out for what happens with this asteroid, it's amusing to me that this same plot line was used just a couple of years later for an episode of Star Trek. As a matter of fact, my favorite episode of Star mm-hmm. Trek, The Doomsday Machine from Season 2.
Yep, great, great, great.
Absolutely, written by Norman Spinrad, one of my favorite science fiction authors of all time. But it is basically the same plot line. It's an actual mechanical machine mm-hmm. in the Star Trek episode. And in this, it is a possibly living asteroid that may or may not be trying to cause this problem. But it's essentially the same plot. Someone has to give up their life to destroy this planet-destroying thing. So that it's kind of neat that I suspect that there are more movies / television episodes
I'd say probably
that have used
so.
That same storyline as years have gone by. But the kind of shock of realizing that this story was done three times within the space of 5 years. It's kind of neat, and it also mm-hmm. shows just what level of story was being mined for science fiction films at that time. Science fiction films and science fiction television, which is, you know, basic obvious stories. The Doomsday Machine has always been. You could always have looked at that as essentially a retelling of Moby Dick,
mm-hmm.
and in a way, that's. It's very easy to see the parallels, but it's also very easy to see the parallels between this film and the previous film with Claude Rains, and they're basically the same story. It's kind of cool, but then
it's
again,
kind of cool. But then again, in this movie, the dick is Rod Jackson,
and he gets to survive, which he's got to go on to the sequel, damn it. He's got to deal with another type of alien in the next movie. So that's just the way it is. Think about it, in Star Trek, they can't let Kirk kill himself destroying the machine. They have to introduce a whole other character to play Ahab. So
mm-hmm.
there is that.
Well, one other thing I wanted to go back and say that it was a little touch, but you were asking things that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
In the movie, and it was something that as I saw it, I thought that was kind of cool. It was the sequence where they go outside the ship to do a little spacewalk.
Yeah.
And as they walk on sort of the surface of the ship, they like stomp down really hard, like the boots are magnetic or like they've got that simulated gravity outside. And it's just a little thing, but it's something that you wouldn't usually get at the time. You know?
No, that's true.
It's kind of like the thing that the gravity goes off and the paper floats away. it's just a little touch that, okay, that's kind of a nice idea there. They did something good that they didn't have to, so it gave it a little extra point for that.
Well, tell me something. I'm pretty sure that this is not a film. None of the Gamma One films are the kind of movie that you could introduce to a modern audience, say someone under the age of 25.
They'd have to be really open-minded.
Get really open-minded. Yeah. And really willing to enjoy something along these lines, because this is, I always like to talk about some of these films being acquired tastes. Mm-hmm. And this really fits the bill of being an acquired taste. If this is something that you know you're going to enjoy, you're probably going to go into it and, you know, judge it on a different scale than someone who really has no time for this kind of thing. I don't imagine, well, I hate to say it, but we're more and more to the point where, and I say this as someone who loves spectacle, as long as the effects are nice, people are willing to give a lot of things a pass.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment the special effects start to slack off, or they feel that the special effects aren't up to what they consider they should be, then they don't give a shit. They're not willing to give a story an extra bit of willing suspension of disbelief and roll with it and let a good story be told regardless of being able to see the seams or the wires.
Mm-hmm.
And just enjoy themselves and judge the story as the story. So this is a film with a very narrow audience in the 21st century. It's someone who either already has some nostalgia for this kind of story, saw it as a kid, has an interest in science fiction cinema that kind of precludes time and distance and quality level. In other words, they're willing to, because of their love of the genre, let a lot of those critical faculties fall to the side and just kind of take it in and try to enjoy it for what it was and think of it as a piece of the time in which it was created. So these movies, the Gamma One movies, I have recommended Wild Wild Planet and War Between the Planets to, or War of the Planets, I should say, to people before, but I've known who I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm talking to people who listen to, say, the B-Movie podcast, I know I can recommend these films, and they're probably going to get a kick out of it because they already are the kind of people who enjoy that kind of thing. It's the same as if I wanted to recommend, let's say I wanted to recommend Kill Baby Kill, or the Mask of Satan, or Black Sunday, or Black mm-hmm. let's say Black Sabbath. There's a certain audience, I should say, that I could recommend that to, and be confident that they would enjoy it, and not really worry too much about it. But there are other people that I know it would be pointless to try to get them. They wouldn't make it 5 minutes.
Oh no, absolutely. If somebody says, you know, I really love Guardians of the Galaxy, what's another really fun science fiction movie that I should check out? This probably isn't the first one you're going to point them to.
Depending on their age, you probably can't go back much further than The Matrix before they start to go, hey, wait a minute, that looks like shit.
Yeah, but, you know, Rod and I, old codgers that we are,
grew up watching this stuff.
So, yeah, I do forgive a lot. And in this movie, you know, one of the first things, and almost immediately I had to realize, I've got to look past this and see if you noticed this. Well, I'm sure you noticed it. This thing is just drowning in technobabble.
Oh, I know. It's like, oh my Lord. You thought Star Trek The Next Generation was bad with technobabble. Holy mm-hmm. Jesus. Yeah. And it's almost as if that's how they realized they were going to have to stretch the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a way to keep... Part of it I understand because they're showing these people doing their various jobs on the space station, and so these guys they're talking about what they're doing, they're talking about the results of doing the things they are and how that relates to the plot and how this shows them X, Y, and Z. But there does come a point with some of the dialogue where you're just going, "Wow, that was a string of gibberish."
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and it's. I think one of my favorite bits is like, well, from now on, all transmission will be in the clear. In the clear? Yes, they will all be in the clear. So I hope this podcast is going to be in the clear.
In the clear!
And then later on, the boss comes aboard and says, and now all communications will be in the clear.
And it's like, from context, you finally figure out what the hell they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other bits of technobabble that I'll say this. You're right about the technobabble, but there were moments when I thought the technobabble was kind of cool.
I did too, and again, that's something that the second viewing was less of a problem for me, because the first time through, there were some things like, what are they talking about? But watching it a second time, what they're talking about is this thing that's going to happen later.
Yeah.
That it doesn't make any sense right now. So, but in it, I don't know, they're just good. There was a lot.
There is a lot to talk about. I will not dispute that.
Returning to the major disturbances, those in authority estimate that thousands of families are homeless. In European coastal cities, business districts have been almost totally destroyed. Among other losses are 50,000 pieces of mail washed away when the post offices were inundated. Governments are having extreme difficulty maintaining order. We've just received an announcement from the UD. Commander Rod Jackson will be in charge of the survey unit to investigate the possibility
of
a space disturbance. To this end, he'll be taking the recently completed neutron deflector to his base command post, Gamma 1.
God help us.
We have an immediate 5-7 with full priority.
Of course, Lieutenant. Priority it is. 5-7? That's top secret. This really is trouble, isn't it?
Here's your code key, and kill those newscasts.
Yes, sir, Lieutenant.
Now, here's the thing. I always try... I grade all films that I watch, keep a log, and I grade them on a 1 to 10 scale. 1 being, oh my God, what the fuck have I watched? Mm-hmm. And 10 being, my Lord, it's full of stars. So, here's my question for you. I don't rate this film particularly high. It mm-hmm. is the worst, in my opinion. It is the worst of the four Gamma 1 films. But, by the way, I didn't... Spaceman, his first... Spaceman, a.k.a. Assignment Outer Space. I did not like that film either. I thought it was insanely dull. And some of that dullness, I feel, is in this movie as well. So, my feelings on this one is that it's not particularly great. But... there's an audience for it, and we're it, sad to say.
Yeah, exactly. If we don't like it, nobody's going to.
And the thing is, I vacillated between a 3 and a 4 on the 1 to 10 scale. And I, after my second viewing, going through and making some notes, I was like, okay, honestly, second viewing actually made me appreciate it more, even though I've seen this movie before. This made me feel like, okay, I'm gonna land on a 4 with it. That's fine. I don't think it's a particularly good movie. It's the last one of the series of Gamma 1 movies that I would recommend. It's pretty far down on my list of Antonio Margheriti directorial features. So it's going to be in the lower 40 percentile on his resume. So did you think about where it would fall for you on the 1-10 scale?
I did. And before I give you the... my rating there, I did want to say that I like this way more than enough to be interested in seeing more of this guy's stuff.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I've seen more of it than I thought that I had, but it was fun. There was some good stuff in there. There was a lot to recommend it. I was going to go with a 4 also, until it occurred to me that the thing that's causing all these problems on Earth, when it really comes down to it, are farts.
What? Wait a minute.
The
wait.
Planet on the
Help
prowl.
Me. Help me.
The what? Planet on the prowl. The space wind. There's even a bit where they said, look at that expulsion of gas. The space wind is causing the problems on Earth.
Oh my God.
Space farts are the problem. Everything from the tidal waves to the loss of 50,000 pieces of mail all comes down to space farts. And for that, I'm going to rate this 4.5.
So an extra 0.5 because you figured out that the planet on the prowl has got a flatulence problem.
Exactly. That was a bold move. And you know, I got to give him an extra 0.5 for that.
You know, now that I've had time to absorb that, this will be the last podcast that Mr. Hudson and I will be
But really, that is what was going on. If that planet was a living being, the space wind was what was causing the problems. It was, they even say in there that that wind is creating some sort of chain reaction in space that's going back to Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
And the planet is expelling gas. They even say, look at that giant gas expulsion.
Okay, this is causing me actual physical pain to say this, but holy shit, you're right. And the fact that it didn't occur to me, I'm too busy drawing parallels to Moby Dick and fucking Star Trek.
And I'm thinking about farts. That's why I'm here.
The answer was right in front of my face. Which is a really depressing thing to say when we're talking about farts.
You really hadn't thought of that?
No, I had not thought about that. No, I had not.
I mean, I really wasn't even, I mean, it was funny, but I wasn't trying to be that funny, because if this thing's pumping blood, it's got veins and arteries.
Clearly,
it's got an immune system inside it, and its gas expulsions are what's causing the problems. It's space farts.
Space farts. You know, it's odd that they never gave that the film that title.
They should have.
Space farts. Space farts. 1966. MGM release. Oh my god.
And they should have just used a Beano bomb.
Jesus. Oh god. Somebody somewhere just needed to say Bromo. Bromo. Okay. I hate to say you've broken my brain. So I'm going to extract myself from this conversation and say that I promised that I would do more podcasts with you, and I'm not going to back away from that now. You have tested me, sir.
But I'm right.
You're right, and it's depressing. So okay, there we go. There we have it. Planet on the Prowl, aka War Between the Planets, by director Antonio Margheriti. A filmmaker who we will return to, hopefully somewhere in May. We will sit down and have another conversation about another Antonio Margheriti film. As a matter of fact, we'll go ahead and talk about, and I hope there are no farts in these movies. It's been a few years since I've seen them.
Let's see if there's a flatulence through line.
If there's a flatulence through line through Antonio Margheriti films, you are the man to find it.
Well, I'm looking for it now.
Yes. Anyway... Folks, next time out, when Mr. Hudson and I next sit down to podcast here in a couple of months, we're going to be talking about another Antonio Margheriti film. What we're going to do is we're going to do a little bit more research than average, because Antonio Margheriti is one of the few directors to have done a very odd thing. Antonio Margheriti made a film and then a few years later remade the same film. Very few filmmakers have done this. Hitchcock,
that's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, he did it with Man Who Knew Too Much. Michael Haneke did it with the film Funny Games. He made he made that one twice. And there are a couple of other directors who have remade their own films. But Antonio Margheriti made a fantastic little gothic horror film in black and white called Castle of Blood, starred Barbara Steele. One of her several gothics made in Italy in the 60s. And then just a few years later, in 1970, he remade it in color. Same story. Pretty close to exactly the same script. And he remade it as a film called Web of the Spider. So what we're going to do is we're going to podcast about both versions of the film. Both versions. We're going to watch... I'm probably going to end up watching at least two different versions of Web of the Spider. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about both the black and white original and the director's very own remake of his own movie, Web of the Spider. So, next time we talk, we will be discussing Castle of Blood and Web of the Spider by Antonio Margheriti. Now, you've not seen either of these films.
I have not, and I was just going to say this again. I'm really excited about this, because everything that Rod and I have done so far has been a film that I knew a lot about going in. And with these, I really am coming in blind, and I'm going to try and keep it that way. I'm not going to work ahead or anything. So I'm going to let you educate me as we go, and I'll occasionally find the hidden fart in the room. But no, this is going to be great. I'm looking forward to this, and hope you guys are along for the ride with us.
Well, for those wanting to follow along, Castle of Blood is readily available. Synapse put it out on DVD a few years back, and the DVD is still in print and available from the last time I checked. Once again, it's Castle of Blood with Barbara Steele. And the film Web of the Spider is a bit more difficult to get your hands on. I first turned up a copy of it on a cheap multi-film DVD set several years ago. So it's around. I think it's one of those that's kind of fallen into a weird public domain kind of situation. I'm not positive, but it's not that hard to find. Web of the Spider is not that hard to find. So
is it on YouTube in its entirety? A lot of that public
domain stuff.
It probably is.
I bet you could probably find Web of the Spider on YouTube. That is true. So that is what we'll be talking about next time, and then after that we'll probably try something else. Well, we'll definitely try something else by Mr. Margaretti, but I'm wondering if we should maybe try a Western after that.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, cool. Well, all right, folks. We will talk to you next time. And please, if you want to join us, check out some Margaretti films. If you've got anything you want to tell us about, space farts, Antonio Margaretti.
Remember that great Sid Marty Krofft show, Space Farts?
I was on right after Jason of Star Command, right? I seem to always confuse that and Buck Rogers. Yeah. Well, at any rate, you can write us at thebloodypit@gmail.com. Write us, let us know what you think, give us any ideas. If there's an Antonio Margaretti film that you think we should cover, let us know. Maybe we'll speed up production on these things and try to get one out a month or something like that, because there's certainly a lot of ground to cover with this man's film. So,
how many movies does he have out there that you know of?
Oh, my goodness. The official IMDb listing for number of directorial credits for Margaretti is 57.
Okay.
I think, honestly, that's probably a little inflated because his name got attached to something that came out in 2010, and unfortunately he passed away long before then.
Was John Carradine in it?
Possibly. But Ark of the Sun God is one of the movies he made that you might be aware of.
I think I've seen
kind that. Of a Raiders of the Lost Ark ripoff?
Yeah.
And that's something we might ought to cover. Yes. Mr. Hercules Against Karate. So that's not something I want to cover. Anyway.
I don't know.
I haven't seen that one either. So, honestly, looking at his whole list, there's probably, I'd say, a good 45 films to cover if we wanted to cover them.
That'll keep us busy for a while. And if we throw in some side roads here and there, we can go forever.
Well, I think about it this way. I mean, Raro Video has put out a Blu-ray of The Long Hair of Death, which is one of his gothics. All four of the Gamma One films are available. Naked You Die is available. Couple of three of his spaghetti westerns are available. Maybe actually four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Gunfighter and the Stranger is one of them, and that's available. There's a comedy he did called The Squeeze, which I've never seen, which always seems kind of fascinating. Killer Fish is about to get a Blu-ray release.
Again, one of those things. Wow.
Yeah. I've still not seen Hunters of the Golden Cobra. So there's a lot out there. One of his action movies from the 80s, Commando Leopard, I have seen, and it's damn good. But there's a lot to cover, and like I say, if there's one of these on the list that you think that we should cover, I can see that there's probably a lot of Hunters of the Golden Cobra fans out there. Or Cannibal Apocalypse, who the hell knows. Mm-hmm. A lot of John Saxon fans as well. But I tell you what, we will get back to you the next time around and talk about Margaretti. And until then, thank you very much for listening. Write to us if you have any ideas. And just generally, thank you very much for downloading and listening to us babble about these weird-ass films. I am Rod Barnett.
And I'm John Hudson.
We'll see you next time.
All right, see you soon. We'll be right back.
Commander Rod Jackson has set forth an answer to Echo's desperate call for help. And if his hunch is right, he will see for himself the horror stalking outer space. Whatever it is, it has avoided detection by the powerful video scopes scanning the skies.